Welcome to Main Street on this Thursday here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Later, we'll dive into the world of tornadoes with a special report from Prairie Public News reporter Danielle Webster, followed by a review of the movie Twisters with Matt Olean. Dave Thompson will also bring us up to speed on this week's top news stories. But first, we'll head to Essentia Health's Cancer Clinic in Fargo with alarming reports about an increase in cancer cases among younger Americans. We wanted to explore whether this trend is affecting North Dakota. What's driving the rise and what can be done to address it? We begin our conversation with oncologists Dr. Basim Kabrasi and Dr. David Schwartz. Dr. David Schwartz, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you today.
With recent news stories that have talked about the greater incidence of cancers in younger people, and that's where I'd like to start today, Dr. Schwartz, and I'm very, very interested in your explanation of why certain cancers are becoming more common in younger generations, Generation Xers, millennials. Is that trend not only a national trend, but also a trend here in North Dakota?
Well, I think this is a very important topic, not only for the immediate news cycle, so to speak, but also in terms of the overall ability to care for the upcoming populations that we're going to be seeing. As you know, cancer is a very diverse disease. It's not just one thing. It's multiple different types of diseases and with multiple different causes. And we have a population that is basically aging, but we are seeing cancer incidences that are different now, in part because we have better screening, we have better ways of detecting cancer and diagnosing it, and because we have, frankly, more access to diagnostic technology than we did when the older generations, who were kind of aging out of the screening time, when those folks are being replaced by younger patients, we're seeing it more. It's becoming more of an issue to deal with. And what we really want to do is we want to figure out how can we best address this particular problem.
Dr. Basim is joining our conversation. They are oncologists here at Essentia Health in Fargo. Is it a matter of our diagnostic expertise is better, or are younger people with cancers that they didn't have before?
I think it is a combination of having better access to diagnostic ability now, and it is a combination of having an increased incidence of cancer in younger patients. Some of the news stories that you mentioned in brief at the beginning or alluded to, those have centered around scientific reports published in the medical literature that look at the incidences of cancer occurrence in younger generations, younger people. My generation, Generation X, which is not expected compared to historical trends. And the question is, why, what's causing it, how can we affect it, and what can we do to prevent it? Is it happening in North Dakota? Yes, it's happening in North Dakota just as it is in every other state within the United States. But it is a phenomenon that we're becoming much more aware of now.
If I just may add to the first question. So I think it's real. I think it's really, we're getting younger people with cancer. And in general, it's not because of better testing, although we do have better testing, because younger people are not screened for cancers. So in general, a screening test, a test that you do when you don't feel anything, when you don't have any symptoms. And it's not done on everybody. It's done in certain high-risk groups. And today, the recommended screening tests are screening tests that show a survival benefit. So if a test, you find the cancer early, but it doesn't make a difference, it's not recommended to screen. For example, for leukemia or pancreatic cancer, you don't make that much of a difference, or there's more damage than good. For example, in the 60s, the Mayo Clinic did lung cancer screening by x-rays for patients who had a smoking history. They found they biopsied a lot of benign lesions, and the biopsies caused more damage than early detection saved lives. So it was recommended for the longest time against screening for lung cancer. Now we have better screening tests, better ways of reading them. It's recommended to screen for lung cancers because finding it early actually saves lives. So colon cancer makes a difference. So we recommend screening, and that age has come down to 45. But we are seeing patients with colon cancer at 30 and they're not being tested, but they come in with low blood, anemia, abdominal pain, and the testing then isn't anymore a screening study, it's a diagnostic test, and that would have been done even with more primitive testing methods. You know, if someone came, and we're talking in the last 20 years, I mean, 20 years we weren't seeing any of this stuff, and a lot of the stuff, the scans were available 20 years ago, the colonoscopies were available 20 years ago. For breast cancer, we get young people with breast cancer, they're not doing screening. You know, if you're in your 20s, if you don't do, how do you present to your doctor? You present with a breast mass, and then he'll do the tests. But those are not because we have better tests, because those patients are tested when they have symptoms. When we diagnosed cancer in these younger patients, it's because they're presenting with symptoms, not because we're sort of doing scans on everybody. I mean, if we do a PET scan on everybody, we'll detect a bunch of cancers, but it's because they're presenting with symptoms. So we're getting people who are in their 30s presenting with jaundice. Their face, their eyes are yellow. They do scans. They find they have cholangiocarcinoma. And so it is happening. It's real, I think. It's a real phenomenon.
I agree with what Dr. Cabrosi is saying. We are in full agreement on this. But I think it's important to talk about maybe some definitions here for the audience. When we say young, we're not talking about 16-year-olds. We're talking about 50-year-olds. We're talking about younger people than we are used to seeing with cancer. So Dr. Gabrosi is absolutely right. We would not be doing necessarily screening tests on a patient who is 20 for breast cancer, but we would, you know, potentially do it for a 45-year-old, for instance. But in the reference to the recent news reports that have come out and the scientific reports that they are referencing, young is defined in that 50-year-old type demographic.
Sure. Even so, is it environment? Is it lifestyle?
Yes.
Do we know?
Yes.
Can't be genetics, right? Because genetics, they change over hundreds of generations, or at least tens of generations. So we're talking about changes that we're seeing in the last two generations. And we definitely want to say environment. But what's environment? Is environment what you eat and what you drink? Is it what's in the water and vegetables and meat that we eat? No, they're the feeds, the artificial feeds. Is it not moving because you're getting, your brain's getting satisfied sitting and watching TV? Or, you know, my grandparents used to have to work to eat. And we work to eat, but our work is very different. So they used to have to farm, harvest, basically move their bodies. And if you go back hundreds of generations before that, that's the way it was. You were hunter, gatherers, or farmers. And so when today we want to labor, it's considered a job that is sort of menial, and people don't do as much, and more people tend to do stuff that doesn't need physical activity.
So you're suggesting a sedentary lifestyle is a big influence on
it. And we're proud of ourselves if we go to the gym for an hour, you know, whereas in the old days it was normal to go to the gym for 8 hours, but that gym was nature. And Dr. Schwartz actually brought to our attention several big studies that show a very big effect. We're talking 50%.
Yes.
50% of what? Put that in.
So we were talking about this question of what can we do to prevent cancer with respect to the lifestyle, with respect to the sedentary exposure that we get from a young age now. What about diet? What about sleep? Those kinds of things. All of those things absolutely have an impact on cancer incidence. Dr. Cabrosi is exactly right. There is no clear genetic change that is occurring, but there is an influence of the environment on a person's genetics. Those influences are most readily visible in something like the Harvard Nurses Study, for instance, where a bunch of nurses working at Harvard were evaluated and just followed for a long period of time. And the interesting thing is that when you look at nurses who had breast cancer, for instance, and you compare this group of women, all of whom had the same treatment, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and you looked at the women who exercised, had some kind of moderate exercise, ate a low-fat diet after their diagnosis, compared to the ones who didn't, there was a 50% reduction in cancer recurrence. If we had a drug that caused 50% reduction, people would be jumping up and down at conferences, hailing it as the most important blockbuster thing in breast cancer since the advent of endocrine therapy, like tamoxifen. But this is something that we have the ability to do individually. So yes, there are things that we can do to help decrease the incidence of cancer recurrence, but also to help decrease the incidence of cancer coming up in the first place.
Over time, it seems to me, our advice for screenings has changed and has become a little uncertain at times, 50-45 for a colonoscopy. My wife has talked about mammographies at 40 or 50. Now, what are we supposed to do? And there's a little ambiguity, I would say, in what those screening, I guess, advice is. How do people know? And what's the definitive place where someone can get current advice on best screening, I guess, tactics?
Really, it has to be with your primary care provider. So screening is his responsibility. Explaining the pros and cons of screening is his responsibility. For example, mammogram is the screening study of choice, and that's mainly because of cost, not because of quality, because a screening MRI would be, I think, better. But mammograms become less accurate once you're under 40. So they become less sensitive in younger patients where you have much less incidence of cancer. And they become more sensitive in older patients where you have more incidence of cancer. And that line between 50 to 45 to 40 changes as the incidence of breast cancer changes. So when you get more breast cancers in patients under 50, I mean, if you go back to the 1950s, it was about 10% of people under 50 had breast cancer. Now, in some populations, it's 50% of cases are under 50.
Is that true here in the United States?
In the United States, it's trending that way, but I think it's probably about 20 to 30% of cases
are very significant. 30,
but it's still significant. And for example, statisticians, they get one piece of data. For example, from a university screening center where all they do is screen breast cancers. And they say, well, you know, screening once every 2 years will cut the cost in half and not too many people get missed. But if you're missed, that's 4 years between screening studies. And if you're in the community where the radiologist does look at screening mammograms, but they also look at brain MRIs, CTs of the chest, they might not be as honed in to detect a very tiny change as a person who all he does is screen mammograms, as in that recommendation that was made by statisticians to do screening studies every 2 years. Many of us, you know, who are in the field never really agreed with that and never followed it. And a few years later, that recommendation was rescinded. And that really tells you that this field, especially cancer screening, is constantly being researched and scrutinized. And so even though recommendations are changing, it's like honing in on the best formula and following how population statistics and incidence of cancers changes and the age migration as we're seeing now. And following that, you know, if the first thing is you're detecting cancer in younger patients, following that, there'll be studies about screening in younger patients. And when you follow these, the screening studies will show, okay, it is useful to screen at a different age, and then the recommendations are made.
What's my responsibility as a patient, or what's your advice to me as a patient when I go see my provider? What questions should I ask? Should I ask every time that we visit, what cancer screenings are appropriate for me now? Is that just a simple question that should be asked?
That's a perfect question, you know, because a lot of the time what happens is a family friend, for example, may have pancreatic cancer And you're like, doc, I need to get tested for pancreatic cancer. But testing for pancreatic cancer, if you're not symptomatic, if you feel fine, and you don't have a family history, can be detrimental. And so...
How can a test be detrimental? Explain that just a little bit.
Let's say I went to the doctor and said, listen, doctor, I need to catch pancreatic cancer early. It's deadly. And
true statement.
Yes. And the doctor would tell you, are you feeling anything? Is anything bothering you? Do you have a family history? You're like, no, I feel great, you know? He's like, okay, if we do this test, we might find an abnormality. You'll find a cyst on your kidney, a cyst on your liver, and these are benign findings. But you might find something slightly abnormal with the pancreas. You try to biopsy the pancreas, for example, and the pancreas itself secretes all the digestive fluid that sort of activates with another fluid to digest meat. So if you injure the pancreas, you might end up to have pancreatitis, which could be deadly. How many people would you have to biopsy to catch enough cancers early enough to offset the damage done by giving someone pancreatitis who's perfectly healthy? So these tests, especially since in cancer, the gold standard of diagnosing cancer is a biopsy. So to get a biopsy, you have to do an invasive procedure, and that's associated with risks. And okay, and then if we do this and nothing, we pull it off without any complications, and we tell you there's no cancer, do you want to do it again next year and the year after? So what we do before any recommendations are made in the field of oncology, we have to show that a certain intervention provides a survival benefit in a randomized controlled trial. But that means if I take 1,000 people and I don't know what's going on, and half of them follow screening test A and half of them follow screening test B or no screening at all, and I follow these patients for 10 years, if I find a group does better, then I'll make that recommendation. And that's the way, because a lot of things that we end up doing are not intuitive as we think they are. They turn out like the lung cancer screening study that the Mayo did in the 60s. We thought it was going to save lives. It ends up that screening in that way hurt people.
My mother at the end of her life was seeing an oncologist. And I recall him saying that, look, in the future, there'll be a blood test that can really help about a lot of the things that we're talking about today. We there? We getting there?
We're getting there, I think. You know, diagnostic studies, probably the holy grail would be something like a blood test, to where we could take a sample, a relatively simple sample of someone's blood, and then be able to tell whether that person actually has a cancer going on that we just haven't been able to see or detect yet, or whether or not they're at high risk to develop a separate cancer down the road. There are genetic testing that we can do for cancers now. But are we there yet in terms of a general screening? No, because that has to be deployed at scale. And to be effective, a screening test has to be widely available. It has to be relatively inexpensive, and it has to have a high sensitivity, meaning it's going to catch cancers that are there. And it also has to have a relatively high specificity, meaning that the times when it shows up positive, it actually is positive for exactly the reasons that Dr. Cabrassi just mentioned. It is possible to cause hurt or harm to someone if we are too aggressive with over-diagnosing things.
There are people that are listening, I think, that are saying, this is all well and good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have insurance.
Correct.
I can't get screened. I went to the health fair thing and they said, I did this one screening for a particular type of cancer, but I don't have insurance. What advice would you give to younger people who don't maybe go to a general practitioner or someone who is worried about the cost? Is there something that they can do relatively?
Well, of course, prevention is cheap. It's probably the number one most important intervention that you can do.
Quit smoking.
For cancer, is to stop smoking if you smoke. A close second is daily exercise. And we're not talking complex gym membership or, you know, getting your heart rate up to 120 for 2 hours. We're talking about the benefit starts with walking 10 minutes a day, as long as you do it every day. It increases up to half an hour. If you do half an hour of exercise a day, which includes walking, there's a major improvement in your health all around. Those two things will save you money if you don't have insurance because you won't have to see doctors. Third is diet, and that we all know the healthy diet. It's eating stuff that you can understand and pronounce. You know, when you look at these labels, it gets really confusing. So those three things are preventative, and it's the stuff your mom tells you, your grandma tells you, it makes common sense. Fast food and take a cholesterol pill, you know, rather than eating healthy. And
yes,
so we want the easy way out.
Yes, we do. Unfortunately, that's human nature, right?
That's that. There is significant value to detecting cancer early.
There is. There is significant value to detecting cancer early. Prevention is key. And I will just one more thing on the prevention side of it. One of the biggest impacts on human health in history has been vaccines. What vaccine do we have for cancer? Well, the most important one is the HPV vaccine. And since we're talking about younger populations, HPV stands for human papillomavirus. It is a type of virus that can cause cancer. Historically, we have heard about it in things like cervical cancer in women, anal cancer in both men and women, and now head and neck cancers is becoming much more prevalent. So Dr. Gavrassi will agree we are seeing more and more patients now with head and neck cancers that are what we call HPV positive, and these are younger patients.
Usually we see those in patients who smoke and drink a lot routinely. More recently, and this is maybe one example where we have better testing, because on a molecular level, we can detect the DNA, either antigens or DNA markers of the human papillomavirus. And those cancers have their own special way of treating them, because they do much better than the ones that are caused by smoking and drinking in the throat and in the tongue and the tonsils. Yeah,
exactly. The types of cancers that we're talking about with these HPV mediated, we call it, we have a vaccine against human papillomavirus. That vaccine has already made a huge impact in cervical cancer incidence in the United States. It is expected that it will also have an impact on the other types of cancer within the United States and probably worldwide. If you look at the overall cost of disease to society and what is the most efficient way to impact that disease, vaccines are right up there at the top of the list. So I would just advocate to our viewers that if you are eligible, if you're younger and you're eligible for a human papillomavirus vaccine, HPV vaccine, or if your children are potentially eligible.
At what age?
The earliest, I think, is 11, right? It's early. The earlier, the better. Absolutely both. HPV is a non-discriminator in terms of how it affects people. We would want all of the population that is eligible to potentially receive this vaccine after discussing it with your physician or your healthcare provider, because it's effective, it's relatively cheap, and it has a potentially tremendous impact on how a person is going to run into this problem of cancer at some point in their lives, whether it's with them earlier on or whether it's with a family member later on. If you can get those folks vaccinated early, hopefully the only impact with cancers of this type would be with people that they know rather than themselves.
Our sincere thanks to the folks at Essentia Health's Cancer Clinic in Fargo. We'll bring you more of our conversation with Dr. Basim Gavrassi and Dr. David Schwartz next week during Main Street. After this break, we'll be talking Twisters with Danielle Webster and review the movie Twisters with Matt Olien. Plus, Dave Thompson follows with this week's news. That's all after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchesne, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
Main Street continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein. 2024 has been a particularly active year for severe weather, with well over 1,000 confirmed tornadoes reported so far. As Prairie Public's Danielle Webster reports, this summer's activity may be reigniting interest in Tornado Alley.
In 2011, there were 1,398 confirmed tornadoes in the United States, the most ever on record. The second most active year occurred in 2008, with 1,303 confirmed tornadoes. At the time of this recording, 2024 is currently the third most active year on record, with 1,250 twisters confirmed to have touched down. For Ryan Mock, the word confirmed is key.
If you ever heard the term confirmed tornado, that's because of us.
Mock is a trained storm spotter and storm chaser. And this summer, he's been putting in a lot of miles on his Subaru Forester, tracking down and filming tornadoes across the Midwest.
I guess in contrast to most tornado videos that are very quick, sometimes very shaky because of the adrenaline and the chaos of the situation, just a quick little clip of a tornado doing this or that or touching down, or even, you know, some of the heartbreaking stuff, seeing it go through a town or damaging a house, I really wanted to do something more of with my own journey with it. I wanted to really bring forth a real, like, homebred feeling.
Mock grew up in and resides in Fargo, and as is the case with many chasers, his fascination started early.
I used to go to this daycare center. I remember there was a tornado warning, and there were clouds out there that I don't know. It might have just been some scuddy clouds, but some severe looking clouds anyway, and I just wanted to be out there and watch it all, and they were like, you're just dragging me inside, you know, and I was like, no, I want to see, you know, and it's always been that.
As a kid, his interest only grew. Mock says he began carefully following storms once he got his driver's license and spent a lot of time self-studying meteorology before he started seriously chasing around 10 years ago. He remembers his first tornado he ever intercepted, Father's Day 2015.
That was in Bison, South Dakota. The tornado risk was kind of elevated that day. The storm relative velocity was pretty high. Yeah, I saw one drop a pretty large cone in just like some nature preserve, thankfully. You know, that didn't really hurt anything. I don't even know what it was rated, but I don't think it did more than maybe tear up some shelter belts or something like that. But that actually, yeah, that day I saw 1, 2, 3 of them. Touchdown.
The chasing community is comprised of a lot of different ideologies and motivations. Mock says he chats regularly with around 30 or 40 other chasers locally. Science and research is top of mind for many, but for Mock, it's more artistic and possibly even spiritual. His YouTube series, The Rear Flank, aims to capture the presence of severe storms and the power of tornadoes.
Patterns change. Frustrations build. You get more aggressive. They say you should never get in the bear's cage, but, well, sometimes the only way to see the wizard is to peek behind that curtain.
Right, we're good. The car's like rocking right now, I know.
So here we go again, to walk amongst the giants.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. I mean, when you're outside of the vehicle, looking at it, just a rip-roaring wall cloud just turning, and it finally throws one down. It is like, there's a presence there. I will, like, go to the grave standing on that. Like, there's something there. So I felt like I wanted to do something different with, in contrast to most tornado videos, and really get more of a short film kind of format out of it. And sometimes when you see those awful things happen out there, I mean, it's like the weight of witness, basically, you know. And it's not really guilt, because I've never really been a person that's just quick to just fly my drone over awful things and then get my footage out to people. Not to knock that, it's just I've tried the media thing, and I've never really been that kind of person. I don't know, it's more of a deeper respect to the nature behind it. And also a respect to the people that it affects sometimes negatively.
Like many Midwest kids, Mock says he was affected by The Wizard of Oz, and he reports habitually renting tornado video classics from Take-Two Video. But Mock's path to The Rear Flank may have begun before he was even born.
Well, so my grandfather, who was a a photographer for the Fargo Forum back in the 1957 tornado. He took some photos, some actually really rather famous photos that won the Forum a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage on it, of the Fargo tornado. And I remember seeing, I saw photos that like no one's even seen, you know, like negatives of, you know, he didn't get the actual tornado itself, but he got a lot of the aftermath.
Mock's grandfather was former Forum managing editor Cal Olson, and the aftermath he photographed of the 1957 Fargo tornado included a devastating, iconic image of a young man carrying the body of a little girl through the ruins of a decimated neighborhood. That twister ended up being one of three tornadoes studied by Japanese-American meteorologist Ted Fujita, which led to the development of the Fujita scale that measures tornado damage. Today, it's known as the Enhanced Fujita Scale. The Fargo tornado was rated F5, which at the time was the highest and most severe level. And the term F5 might sound familiar to mid-90s movie buffs.
Joe! Bill! It's coming! It's headed right for us! It's already here.
I gotta go, Julia. We got cows!
For Ryan Mock and many other chasers, the 1996 film Twister was as inspirational as it was formative, even if it didn't get everything right.
When I saw Twister when I was like 16 years old, before I actually chased a tornado, I thought it was the best thing in the world. It was like, oh my God, that's it, I can't wait. And yeah, that had a lot to do with the drive of me. You actually want to go out and do this later on in life. Now, in retrospect, it's almost like me as an ICU nurse watching Grey's Anatomy. There's a lot of cringe, like, oh God, did they really just say that? That's not how that works. Those types of things. There's a lot of cringe moments and eye-rolling moments, but at the same time, like, Twister is such a endearing, great film. I'm anxious to see the next one for sure.
The next one he's referring to is the highly anticipated and just released summer blockbuster Twisters, which is more of a follow-up film than a sequel to the original. Mock says he fully expects this new film to inspire a whole new generation of chasers, which he says is a good thing. He encourages newbies to take a spotting class, always have an escape route away from the weather, and when picking a vehicle to chase in, choose wisely.
I'd say something with this all-wheel drive would be great if you need to get out of a really slimy gravel road. And some good tires, yeah.
Yeah,
good tires are good.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And as for why this season has been so active in Tornado Alley, Mock says experts claim this year's exiting El Nino and entering La Nina weather pattern could be the answer. But whatever the reason, Mock and other chasers are keeping their eyes to the skies for the next pursuit.
I am a storm chaser. And some of the best memories I have had have been here. Some of the best friends I have made have been here. Some of the best things that I have done for other people have been here. And some of my biggest heartbreaks have been here. I don't know if I'll do it forever. We come from all walks of life and backgrounds with a common bond to cautiously walk amongst the giants.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Our thanks to Prairie Public News reporter Danielle Webster. And speaking of storm chasers, Madeline reviews the movie Twisters. That's after this short break.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing the American indie folk band The Head and the Heart with Michigander to Bluestem Amphitheater in Moorhead, Tuesday, August 20th. More information at jadepresents.com.
There's the fanfare. That means it's time to blow into the movies with our in-house movie reviewer, Matt Olean. And Matt, how are you today?
I'm good, Craig.
calls himself the Tornado Wrangler.
If you feel it,
Jason!
I said if you feel it,
Jason!
And here we go with our movie review, Matt. The movie, the new movie, Twisters. I guess, is this Twisters version 2? Is that what we're calling it?
You really don't have to see the first film to see this movie. It's not related at all, except for they're chasing tornadoes. So that's the plot.
Special effects, tornadoes, stuff blowing everywhere. Any cows coming across our windshield in this one?
Nothing in that one, but be prepared for a high body count in this one.
Ooh,
yeah, so... So this is Twisters.
I mean, the obvious question is, how does this one compare?
I think it compares favorably. I think Lee Isaac Chung was an interesting director choice. He's coming off his big success with Minari, which was his autobiographical film about growing up in Arkansas with his South Korean parents, which ended up being one of the better COVID films. So huge departure going from a family drama to directing a huge big budget action picture. This has grossed $222 million already domestic. Now, if it wasn't for Deadpool and Wolverine, this would be the hit of the summer, but it's still a huge hit. I would describe this as a two-hour merry-go-round ride. You get exactly what you pay for. There's going to be big special effects, which I think will be right in there for the Oscar Visual Effects Award later this year when the nominees come out. The effects are great. I did like kind of the surprising backstory that you get immediately within the first 10 minutes. Not going to give that away, but it really informs the entire movie, especially for the main character who's played by Daisy Edgar-Jones, British actress, most recently seen in Where the Crawdads Sing. And she's good. She kind of fulfills the Helen Hunt role from Twister. She is, you know, this young woman, young girl, who's obsessed with storm chasing, obsessed with meteorology, things like that. But what happens in the opening scene of the film will inform the rest of the film as, you know, we flash forward and she's kind of brought back into the storm chasing, back into Oklahoma through a series of events through her friend played by Anthony Ramos. He's from In the Heights fame. Glenn Powell is in this movie. He's kind of the man of the moment right now, Craig, with his big films Hitman and Top Gun Maverick. He had a big part in that. And Anyone But You was another hit for him last year. He's got this kind of Chris Pratt, down-home country boy charisma. He's the Tornado Wrangler, okay? Tyler Owens shows up in Oklahoma kind of as a competing storm-chasing group, a little more out there, a little more self-promoting than the group that Daisy Edgar-Jones' character joins. Kate is her name in the movie. She joins another kind of competing team in Oklahoma trying to really tame tornadoes. So one of the backstories is her character wants to tame tornadoes, and she's got theories about how to alter the path of tornadoes. I did talk to a friend of mine who does kind of this chasing because I suspected that the technology on this, and I'm a stickler for this, cloud seeding is a thing, Craig, as you know.
Sure.
But to actually affect the path of a tornado and to like affect it in real time and try to get it so it doesn't hit a town is probably technology that's not there yet. So they get into that in the movie, a little outlandish. I also double-checked with my friend, can there be this many tornadoes in like a one-week span in a movie that you're going to see a lot of? He said, it's possible, but they're not all going to be the big ones. They're going to be little touchdowns. I said, okay, so I can accept that. So these are things that happen in the movies, but the effects are great. The body count is high, so be prepared for some stunning moments where, you know, people are just swept away. But in general, I liked it better than I thought I would. It's a merry-go-round ride. It's not going to win any Oscars except maybe visual effects. Glenn Powell has got a lot of charisma. And one thing to keep your eye on this movie, Craig, is in the first 20 minutes, who you might think are the good guys and who you might think are the bad guys, don't assume. But that's another interesting thing I think that they set up is who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in this whole storm tracing adventure, because there is a subplot where you're going to find out that there is some possibly nefarious things going on with all this storm chasing, and there might be up to no good.
In this disaster movie genre, is this one going to have legs? Are we going to be talking about it 2 or 3 years from now, or is this going to wait for version 3 or whatever we're going to call it?
I don't know. You know, Twister, the original film, remains kind of a favorite with people. It made a ton of money. I think it was the second biggest hit of 1996. I think people might still be talking about it. And I think that the young stars suggests that maybe there could be a sequel to this with Glenn Powell and Daisy Edgar Jones and some others coming back. So it's a solid movie. It's a merry-go-round ride. If that's what you're going for, I think that's what you're going
to
get.
Matt, you mentioned last week that another movie was going to be in town from our past, and you got to see it.
Yeah, Lawrence of Arabia, back in theaters. This is the restored version that came out in 1989, where Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese helped David Lean, then alive, the famous director, put in like two or three scenes that were originally cut from the film to make it the restored version. Yeah, saw this at Westacre Cinema Monday night, 7 p.m., got out at 11:02 p.m. We had an intermission to stretch our legs. No. This is a breathtaking movie, and even seeing it now for like the sixth time, I'll say what I said again. It's a miracle of a movie. You wonder how they shot this. It looks and feels differently than any other movie I've ever seen in cinema history. The look of it, it's breathtaking. It's just, there's no way a movie like this could be made today. There's no way that the pacing, you know, is leisurely, but it's necessary as he crosses the desert to get to Aqaba. You know, the famous one that when they take Aqaba from the Turks, from the back, not from the front, from the ocean where the guns are pointing. Some of these scenes go on a long time, but you're completely engaged. And Peter O'Toole's performance, I think, is one of the five best in the history of movies for a lead actor. He's touched by something in this movie. There's like a miracle going on with his work in this movie. Amazing movie. Glad I got to see it on the big screen.
All right, Matt, let's get back to our trivia question. I'm guessing you knew that in 1996, Twister was one of the first movies to be released on DVD, and it did not win any Academy Awards, but it was nominated for two in 97. What two categories were it nominated in?
I will guess visual effects and sound effects editing.
You are right on the money. Matt Olien reviews movies with us each week on Prairie Public. Stay with us.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
And there's the music. We now know it's time to review this week's news here on Prairie Public with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave, it's always great to have you. You took a trip this week to the new Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library that's being built. It's quite a sight.
It is quite a sight. It's going to be a huge complex, and it's really going to be impressive, I believe. And it's about halfway finished. Now, the goal is to get it done and have the official opening on July 4th, 2026, the 250th birthday of the United States. I think they're going to make it now.
What was most impressive to you, Dave, about the place? We were at the Midori Musical about 3 weeks ago. You could see how grand, I think it's going to be, is the word that came to my mind.
Mine too. You know, they've got parts of it, they're explaining it. Part of it's going to be an amphitheater for possible performances or community town halls and forums like that. Part of it's going to be a museum. And then you can take a 3-mile walk around the perimeter and see the Badlands pretty much as they think that Theodore Roosevelt saw it, and how Theodore Roosevelt became such a champion for ecology and preserving these kinds of lands.
Dave, there was flooding in Bismarck and caused you to have a story from the North Dakota Insurance Department really encouraging residents to take stock about not only what they have, but what they have with their insurance policies.
That's correct. The flooding was really amazing because it was one storm. There was flooding on streets. Water went into buildings. Water went into houses. A good friend of mine pretty much lost his ground floor due to the water. So he's right now trying to get that cleaned up. And he's on a list to get a service company over there. And the service companies are really busy right now.
Yeah, sorry to hear that.
But what happened, and it's very serious, Craig, it overwhelmed the storm sewer system.
Dave, back on the museum topic, the State Military Museum floor plan has now been given the thumbs up at a meeting you attended.
That's right, and it's going to be built on the state capitol grounds right next to the Heritage Center. The mock-ups that they showed for the interior are really very impressive, and it will be a salute to North Dakotans and our military history, those who have served in the military, plus what North Dakota has done in terms of having military bases here.
Dave, state revenue collections are really strong. In fact, running about 12% ahead of projections.
Sales tax is really a big driver in that. And when talking to the OMB director, Susan Sisk, she said, we don't have all the figures in yet, so you can tell it's been good. The economy here is pretty good. Oil remains pretty strong. Oil prices remain pretty strong. So a lot of things are working very well. They said one thing you might see a little dip in is income tax collections, but that is the basis, you know, that's because of the income tax relief that the legislature granted in the special session.
Dave, the election is coming up. Certainly one thing that needs to be taken care of is poll workers need to be found and trained.
Right. Now, the Secretary of State says you need about 3,000 poll workers across the state.
Boy, that number really surprised me. That's a lot of folks.
It is. A lot of these people are going to be repeat workers. They're going to come back because they really enjoy it. But there are going to be some openings. And he's encouraging, if you're kind of interested in this, why don't you apply and work at a poll? And he says once you do that, you'll find out how important poll workers are. And you might get a new appreciation for what it means to run an election in North Dakota.
Boy, it's really at the center of democracy, isn't it?
It sure is.
Dave, what are you and your new staff working on? What are we going to hear from you next week?
Well, next week we're going to hear about the continuing attempt to get oil production back up to over 1.2 million barrels of oil. So I'm working on some things that could relate to the use of drones to help fight fires. I think that could be very interesting. Read all about it.
Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story. One thing's for sure, Dave Thompson and his news crew here at Prairie Public will have the news stories for our listeners. Dave, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
You're welcome, Craig.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
North Dakota Council on the Arts, in partnership with the ND Main Street Summit, will be hosting its free biannual statewide arts convening August 27th through the 29th in Watford City. The convening will focus on placemaking with topics that include the Arts Across the Prairie program, attracting a workforce, asset mapping, creating vibrant communities, and strategic planning. Side trips, town walks, receptions, and many other activities are planned. Learn more about the statewide arts convening at arts.nd.gov.
This is Dakota Daybook for August 15th. As each year goes by since Meriwether Lewis and William Clark led an expedition to the West Coast from 1804 to 1806, Americans find new and different ways to honor their legacy and acknowledge the impact of their journey. North Dakota is especially engaged since the expedition spent their first winter camped near present-day Washburn. There they met Toussaint Charbonneau and his wife, Sacagawea, who would join them on their journey. On this date, in 1976, the Lewis and Clark Stamp Club presented a new cover envelope commemorating the passage of the expedition through Mandan in 1806, which was 170 years ago that week. A cover envelope refers to the practice sending a stamped envelope through the mail for the purpose of creating a collectible item. The design of the club's envelope depicted Lewis and Clark and a Liberty emblem as they looked west from Mandan's Crying Hill, with the Missouri River shown in the background. The image was based on a medallion from 1906 and was recreated by a Mandan artist named Michael Kane. The envelopes could be purchased from the stamp club for 10 cents, or with an additional commemorative 3-cent Lewis and Clark stamp for 50 cents. Money from the sales would support club activities. The stamps and envelopes were a clever way for the Stamp Club to commemorate the anniversary. It showcased the work of a local artist, and it was a collectible that could be shared with relative or friend, wherever the mail could take it. Those Lewis and Clark commemorative envelopes could be purchased from the Mandan Post Office or at the Mandan Chamber of Commerce Office. Good luck finding one today. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Ashley Thronson. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you for spending your time with us. Tomorrow at 7 p.m. Central, tune in for Science Friday with Ira Flato. If you usually catch Main Street at 3 p.m. Central, tomorrow we'll be airing The Middle with Jeremy Hobson, who will tackle the provocative question, should there be a legal right to die in the United States? Looking ahead to Monday's Main Street, we'll dive into an intriguing topic of virtual immortality. Is it possible? And more importantly, what are the ethical implications? We'll discuss with Dr. Dennis Cooley from North Dakota State University. All of us here at Prairie Public wish you a wonderful North Dakota weekend. We look forward to having you back with us Monday, right here on Main Street.